This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, comic and actor Chris Gethard, has a new off-Broadway solo show called Career Suicide. That's a comic monologue about his depression and suicidal thoughts. He manages to be genuine and funny at the same time. Gethard also co-stars in the current movie Don't Think Twice, which was written and directed by his friend Mike Birbiglia. Gethard plays a member of a small improv group that's been at it a long time, but hasn't broken through to a large audience, and he's wondering if it's time to give up. Gethard worked with the improv group The Upright Citizens Brigade for about 16 years as a performer and teacher, and for most of that time wondered if he'd ever make it at comedy. But he's becoming better known now through the movie, his stage show, his Fusion Channel show, The Chris Gethard Show, and his podcast, Beautiful Stories from Anonymous People. Terry spoke with Gethard last Monday and began with a clip from his show, Career Suicide. He's looking back on an incident in 2001 when he was 21 years old and having suicidal thoughts. He was driving near his hometown in New Jersey.
I'm behind this truck. The truck puts on the blinker. The driver has decided he's going to turn left. And I don't even slow down. I swing out. I'm going to go around him on the right. And as I do so, he starts coming back into the right lane. It's very clear the driver has decided he's not going to make the turn. And it's also clear I am in his blind spot. He does not see me. And I have time to think to myself, you should hit the brakes. And then I think, no, don't. Because this way it's just a car crash. And this way your parents don't have to go around town being the parents of the kid who killed himself. Because we don't judge people for dying in car crashes, but we do judge people when they die of suicide. It's one of the strangest things I think we've given ourselves permission to do as a culture. And honestly, I think it's really mostly a branding problem. No, I do. I really think suicide has a branding problem because it has a tagline. It has a catchphrase. And I bet a lot of us know it. It sucks. It's really condescending. I bet we've heard it. Suicide, the coward's way out. I bet a lot of us have heard that. What a tagline. Tagline's supposed to get you like pumped up, right? Like Nike, that's a good tagline. Just do it, you know? And I'm not saying that suicide should take that one at all. That's not what I'm saying. Really, none of the big ones apply here. Although, I mean, Burger King, have it your way. I guess that does apply a little bit. And I'll say this too. I don't really understand how it's cowardly to kill yourself. I don't get it. Suicide, when I think of it, to me it means someone had a lot of problems and they couldn't fight through them anymore. That's not cowardly. It's sad and nothing but.
That's Chris Gethard with an excerpt of his show, Career Suicide. Chris, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much for having me on the show. Thanks.
I don't usually start with suicide in an interview. I usually work my way up to that, but I think in this case we'll just start there with your permission. So, why did you decide to do a show in which you talked about some of your darkest thoughts, the kinds of thoughts that scare your family and friends and that you tried to protect them from?
Well, you know, it's funny because a lot of the impetus behind doing this show comes from a conversation I had with my friend Mike Birbiglia. I was on the road with Mike for a long time. Most of 2014, I was opening for him as we toured across the country. And you know, when you're opening for someone and you're out there in the Midwest, there's a lot of like late night drives. And on one of these long drives, he was like, you know, I've heard you make like some jokes about your depression stuff and talk about it a little bit. But what's the real story? Like, what's the darkest it gets? And I actually told him the story that you just excerpted. And at the end of the story, I told him and I thought he was going to be really sad. And he goes, dude, that's hilarious. You have to tell that on stage. And I was like, I don't think so, man. Like, my family doesn't know that story. A lot of people I'm really close to now, they don't really know all the details on that. And he said to me, he's like, you know, if you can get up there and make that funny, you've got something really special on your hands. And I took that as a real challenge. And, you know, I've always sort of talked to this stuff to a certain degree in my work, on my TV show. Like, I've never shied away from it. And I really, a few years ago, made a conscious decision to not be ashamed of it. But that conversation with Mike really, it kind of felt like he was throwing down the gauntlet a little bit.
So I think people who haven't been seriously depressed don't really understand how someone could feel the depth of pain that would drive them to even consider suicide. So Can you help us understand that? Because I think part of bridging the gap is just kind of like understanding what is that level of pain?
Well, for me, when things were at its worst, it felt like I was broken in some way. Also could not figure out how to explain that to anyone in a way that made sense, and that any effort I ever made to try to help myself or reach out to other people could help me made it more isolating. It was a very like quicksand feeling of like, this is only getting worse. I don't know how to stop it. I feel totally alone. I wake up feeling not just sad, but a profound level of isolated sadness. And the more I try to climb out of it, the worse it gets. I think the other thing to keep in mind is the inability to explain it is also one of the things that's so terrifying and isolating in its own right.
You were initially afraid that medication for your depression would blunt your creative edge, but now you feel like, no, it made you funnier, made you healthier and funnier. What are some of the ways that you feel it's been, you know, liberating for you as an artist and performer to have the appropriate medication?
It really helped. Like, the whole romanticized sad clown thing, we gotta get rid of that. That has to go. That's just getting sick people to voluntarily stay sicker and sadder than they have to be. For me, I took medication, and there's a few things. A, my ideas weren't born out of mania anymore. I would go into manic phases, which were as dangerous, if not more so, than the depressed phases. And I'd think I'd come up with the best ideas I ever had. And then the next day, I'd look at them and I'd be like, this is nonsense because it was born out of a manic episode. What a waste of time. And then on top of that, being medicated means that I can get out of bed consistently. I can do second drafts. I can keep things organized. I'm not giving into all sorts of impulsive behavior. Like, I can sit down and work and get things done. So both creatively and organizationally, being medicated has helped me immensely. My career did not start until I was medicated. It is 100%, in my case, undeniable that being medicated helped my creativity.
So, you know, it's interesting, like your show off-Broadway is about depression, but you also have a TV show that's now on the Cable Fusion Network. And that show is really manic. I mean, it's this like talk show, but it's this really manic set. Like, there's a whole bunch of people like on the stage area, and somebody's always like twirling a hula hoop, and there's just like people like shouting and talking, and it's you can describe it better than I can, but it seems like that's the manic side of you as a performer.
Absolutely. And to be fair, I don't know if I can describe it better than you. It's confusing even to me a lot of the time. It's like a real chaotic
mess. It's like a carnival talk show.
Yeah, well, it's like a TV party. Like, and it's a disaster half the time. We don't care if it falls apart. Like, and I'm proud of that. But I will say, I think one of the good things about being a performer is I think I was really smart about using that to channel my manic side towards something more productive than just me, you know, falling off the wagon and partying for 3 days. Like, the TV show definitely reflects my manic side, but I turned it towards productivity in a way that I think has to be a little bit more healthy than some of my past behaviors. So I'll take it. I'll take that trait.
So let's talk about your role in the film Don't Think Twice. It was written and directed by Mike Birbiglia, who also co-stars in it. And it's about this small improv group, and they're having trouble getting noticed. They're also just having trouble keeping it together. They all have day jobs. They attract very small audiences. And at some point in the movie, they're losing their theater, and they're being thrown out of the theater that they've performed in for years. And they think, like, maybe this is the end. Maybe this is the end of the improv group. Maybe it's the end of their comedy careers. And in fact, your character is thinking, maybe life is telling us to just maybe move on. So I'm going to pick it up from there with you continuing your thoughts. And this is as everybody's packing up what they have backstage in the theater and looking at photos and memorabilia.
I feel like your 20s are all about like hope, and then your 30s are all about realizing how dumb it was to hope.
Oh my God, look at you. You look like a little claymation 7-year-old.
Wait, let me see.
That's me, that's a boy.
Who is the one who looks like he's made of flour and water?
I was 21 years old. Like, without the commune, who am I? You know, it's like when I go to the grocery store and People treat me like I don't exist. I'm in my head. I'm like, well, I got a secret. I go on stage, I kill, I crush. I'm a superhero. But without improv, I'm kind of just a loser.
Krista, have you felt that way? Without the comedy, who am I? Without improv, I'm just a loser?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, me being in a film where I play an insecure improviser who wonders if he should quit while his friends get successful is definitely a bit of typecasting.
Has that happened to you? Because in this film, you know, one of the characters in the improv group actually gets cast on a show called Weekend Live, which is the movie's equivalent of Saturday Night Live. And everybody in the group is like kind of happy for him, but at the same time, they're really jealous because they've all wanted that for themselves and he's gotten it. And it just makes them feel even more like failures. Your character in particular.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I think part of why the sense of failure rings true is because that actually happened to me. I was on an improv team with Bobby Moynihan, who's one of my best friends in the world, and he got Saturday Night Live, and it did churn up a lot of insecurities and questions for me. I think one of the main differences in the movie is that Bobby and I have remained super close and supportive of each other, but the feeling of watching your friends move on while you're just waiting your turn, I mean, being at the Upright Citizens Brigade for the many years I've been there, there's a long stretch where that just became a success factory, and a lot of people were telling me I was the next guy for years. I spent about 7 or 8 years being the next guy that was gonna bust out. So I know that feeling.
So what prevented you from just really being jealous all the time? Anything prevented you from that.
I was in my head debating, should I claim the moral high ground and say I wasn't jealous ever? No, I don't think I can say that. I mean, my own insecurities definitely led to me being jealous at times. But that's what it is. It's ego. It's insecurity. And, you know, the older I've gotten, the more I've realized ego just never gets me anywhere good. So I've managed to, I think, keep my head down and do the work that I'm proud of and push back against those feelings of jealousy.
Actor and comic Chris Gethard speaking with Terry Gross last Monday. His off-Broadway show is called Career Suicide. We'll hear more after a break and talk with Anthony Bourdain, host of CNN's Parts Unknown. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview with comic and actor Chris Gethard. He's currently performing a solo show off-Broadway called Career Suicide. It's a comic monologue about dealing with depression and suicidal thoughts. Gethard also hosts The Chris Gethard Show on the Fusion Channel and co-stars in the film Don't Think Twice about a small improv comedy group.
You worked with UCB, the Upright Citizens Brigade, for about 16 years?
Yeah, it's 16 years now.
And they're at this point one of the most famous improv groups because so many people have come out of it, including Amy Poehler. You name some names.
Amy Poehler, Ellie Kemper from Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, Donald Glover, who's on Atlanta right now, Aziz Ansari. So many. Lennon Parham from Playing House, Zach Woods, who's on Silicon Valley, Bobby Moynihan from SNL. Just so many people. Rob Riggle, Rob Hubel, Paul Scheer, Jason Mantzoukas, Nick Kroll. Just an endless list of impressive comedy names.
So what have you loved about improv?
It's just magic. When it works, it's just magic. It feels like you're a part of a greater whole. And when you're in an improv show and it's going well, and it's really, when it goes beyond just, let's say, witty things, and you're really teaming up to create something with 6 or 7 other people, you can feel an audience going, I am watching something that I never thought I'd be seeing tonight, and I don't know how they're doing it. And it can just be really magical and communal. And as a person who never really felt like I fit in a community, to find an art form that's based around creating something that has to be communal, it was so exciting and addictive and eye-opening.
One of the rules of improv as described in the movie Don't Think Twice is get out of your head, stay in the moment. So that's a good place to be for someone like you who's often trapped in your own head.
Oh, big time. One of the really big things that I pushed as a teacher of improv, because I actually probably had as much fun teaching improv as I did performing it, but one of the things I was pushed was like, don't worry about what happened to these characters 10 minutes ago. Don't worry about what's going to happen to them 10 minutes from now. What are they saying to each other right now in this place? Why these characters? Why right now? And that whole idea of just like live in the moment, let this present small moment be enough. Those were things that I think I needed to definitely hear and touch base with all the time.
And apply it on stage, even if you couldn't apply it in your life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is funny, like, as someone who was, I was kind of like a child prodigy at UCB when I started. I was 20 years old when I showed up, and they were like, whoa, who's this young kid? He's pretty good. And to think that back then I spent all day, every day worrying about my past, my future, what's going to happen, what are people thinking of me? And then the fact that the one thing I found that I was good at was an art form that's all about shedding all of those fears, it doesn't totally make sense to me.
Well, maybe it's because it was like so good for you to shed it that it was really like liberating and energizing.
Absolutely. Plus, I think it was the only time I ever felt that way in my life, so it was all I wanted to do. So I practiced a lot. Any excuse I had.
How do you practice improv? What does that mean?
Well, I mean, that's a question I get a lot, and it's funny. It's like, because you know, at the end of the day, improv is an acting style. So it is the sort of thing of you can't practice the content, you can't plan what you're going to say, but you can get in a room with a director and a group of actors and figure out how does my brain interact with the choices that these other actors make. Like, you know, the best improv is not a handful of people who just show up that night and wander on stage. It's people who do it together for years who, you know, when I'm with someone like Shannon O'Neill, who's one of my best friends who I've done thousands of improv shows with, she's the co-host of my TV show, I generally know what she's going to do or say four or five lines before she does it or says it. And I think she'd say the same about me. And like all of that is just by doing it together, both on stage and in rehearsal studios, where you just over and over again learn how these other people's instincts work.
When and why did you stop teaching improv?
Well, I stopped probably around 2009, 2010, and I really had hit a wall, and a lot of it tied in to my depression and dissatisfaction. You know, I started at UCB when I was 20 years old, and it was the most positive thing in my life. It was a place that allowed me to find my identity, to feel confident for the first time ever, but also it had become a safety net and a crutch, and I could feel that. And I also, I don't know, I haven't really told anybody about this. I hit a point where before two shows and then eventually once on stage, I had vicious panic attacks. And a lot of it was about my dissatisfaction with some of my career choices and life choices and feeling stuck. But two different times where I couldn't go on stage because I just broke down. One so severe that they actually hid me in a back room at UCB and called my brother who drove up from Philly to get me out of there. And then another incident, there's the Sunday night show at UCB, it's called ASCAT. It's been running for 20 years. It's very infamous. And I actually had a panic attack on stage one night, and it led to one of the worst nights of my life. So I think I kind of needed to walk away from improv because I'd been doing it since I was 20, and I think I was closely associating it with maybe some of those feelings from when I was 20. There was no real way for me to separate the fact that I grew up using this as a crutch to help deal with problems, but it was a constant reminder of those problems. So around then is when I had started doing stand-up around 2006, and then around 2010, 2011 is when I started just pursuing that much more than improv.
Do you think it was time for you to leave, and the only way you were going to leave is if you were forced to leave, so you forced yourself to leave?
I think to a degree, for sure. I think it's one of those things, you know, I started it when I was 20, and I think I needed to realize that I wasn't going to do it for my whole life. So I had to get out. I had to get out. And I think I wrote it out too long. I wish I just left when I felt that instinct, but I think hanging on a few more years led to it being driven by a lot of panic and mental instability, and that's a shame. You don't want to flee in tears. You don't want to literally run off stage in tears as your way out from this beautiful place that's meant the world to you for your whole adult life. You'd rather just kind of sell out a conquering hero, but nope, not me, not my style. I literally ran out the back door crying, which leads out to a big, big, giant pile of trash bags. That was my goodbye, fleeing out the back door with tears in my eyes.
Well, you know, you had thought of the stage as being like your safe place. So if your safe place leads to a sense of public embarrassment like that, then what's left? It must have been really upsetting.
Absolutely. And if you stake all of your self-esteem on something external like that, then you're, in my case, I was setting myself up for a situation where the bottom was going to fall out.
So what did you do after that?
Well, you know, I continued to do shows there a little while more. And it was the first time in my life I just started skipping shows, not because I was sick or working. I just wanted to do other stuff. And this might be a little bit schmaltzy, but it's true. I remember the first time I ever skipped a show, it was to go on a date with the woman who's now my wife. So I think that's like a perfect reflection of how my priorities kind of changed. I no longer needed to impress an audience of people with my improv skills to feel good. I always felt like I look back and realize I would do a show every Friday night, every Sunday night, and it would be like Friday would get me to Sunday, and I'd feel like I was on that performance high, and then Sunday it was like, please let me have a good enough show that I'll feel good about myself for as many days as possible and just get me back to Friday. That's not a healthy way to live, and that's not real self-esteem. And the fact that what I eventually walked away for literally was to go on a date with my wife, that's the first time I skipped a show, I think it shows my priorities were changing, and I was learning how to feel good about myself just as a person without needing all those pats on the back.
Chris Gethard, it has just been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Likewise, thank you. It is such an honor.
Chris Gethard spoke with Terry last Monday. Gethard's off-Broadway solo show, Career Suicide, has been extended through January 8th. He also co-stars in the film Don't Think Twice and hosts the Chris Gethard Show on the Fusion Channel. Our next guest, Anthony Bourdain, spent decades in the restaurant business, eventually becoming the chef in what he describes as a working-class brasserie in New York. Then he discovered he had a gift for writing and storytelling. He wrote a best-selling book, Kitchen Confidential, then a dozen others. And he became a TV star, taking viewers to places all over the world, exploring local cultures and cuisine, and offering his own unique commentary on what we see. His series, Anthony Bourdain, Parts Unknown, on CNN, is now in its 8th season. A recent show took him to Vietnam, where he ate a bowl of noodles with President Obama. He's also a guy who'll tell you exactly what he thinks, which has led to some public battles with others in the food world. Bourdain has a new cookbook called Appetites. Well, Anthony Bourdain, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to begin with the reading from the book. Share this with us.
What is it that normal people do? What makes a normal, happy family? How do they behave? What do they eat at home? How do they live their lives? I had little clue how to answer these questions for most of my working life, as I'd been living it on the margins. I didn't know any normal people. From age 17 on, normal people had been my customers. They were abstractions, literally shadowy silhouettes in the dining room of wherever it was I was working at the time. I looked at them through the perspective of the lifelong professional cook and chef, which is to say, as someone who did not have a family life, who knew and associated only with fellow restaurant professionals, who worked while normal people played, and who played while normal people slept. To the extent that I knew or understood normal people's behaviors, it was to anticipate their immediate desires. Would they be ordering the chicken or the salmon? I usually saw them only at their worst, hungry, drunk, horny, ill-tempered, celebrating good fortune, or taking out the bad on their servers. What they did at home, what it might be like to wake up late on a Sunday morning, make pancakes for a child, watch cartoons, throw a ball around a backyard, these were things I only knew from movies. The human heart was, and remains, a mystery to me. But I'm learning. I have to. I became a father at 50 years of age. That's late, I know, but for me, it was just right. At no point previously had I been old enough, settled enough, or mature enough for this, the biggest and most important of jobs, the love and care of another human being.
Thanks. And that's one of the reasons you wrote a cookbook about normal food and normal everyday stuff.
Indeed. Yeah.
You write in it, there's nothing remotely innovative in the recipes. You're lifting them from imperfect memories of childhood favorites. Why this kind of book?
Well, I wanted it to be useful, approachable, reflective of the life I've lived over the past 8 or 9 years as a father, as opposed to a professional trying to dazzle with, you know, pretty pictures and food that's different than everybody else's. No, I wanted to make a beautiful cookbook, creative-looking one, spoken in honest, straightforward, casual terms that gives the reader reasonable expectations, that encourages them to organize themselves in the way that I've found to be useful as a professional. But as far as the recipes, you know, when I cook at home, it's with a 9-year-old girl in mind. I mean, she's who I need to please. And if she's not happy, I'm not happy. The whole house revolves around her and her friends. So it's reflective of that. It's also reflective of, I think, age and all those years in the restaurant business. Most chefs I know, after work, do not want to go out to dinner and be forced to think about what they're eating in a critical or analytical way. They want to experience food as they did as children, in an emotional way. The pure pleasure of that bowl of spicy noodles, or even a bowl of soup that their mom gave them on a rainy day when they'd been bullied in school. I mean, that's a happy time, and you can escape this world, you know, and lose yourself in food. So these are recipes that hopefully, where I try to evoke those kinds of feelings and emotions.
You reluctantly address the subject of breakfast. You said, yeah. As a professional, the smell of breakfast was the smell of defeat.
Well, you know, I did not have a particularly prestigious or notable career. And for much of the time as a chef, I was unemployable by respectable businesses. And the only people who would hire me for brunch shifts, because most cooks hated doing brunch for very good reasons. I was good at it, but it was the only work I could get. And I came to hate the, you know, when you're cooking 300 omelets a day and, you know, scraping waffles out of the waffle iron and making French toast and pancakes and, you know, cooking hundreds of pounds of home fries. Those smells, those associations, those were very painful times, you know, addiction, post-addiction. You know, I was a desperate man, often working under a pseudonym when I was cooking brunch. So I really hated it. And I also hated the whole concept of brunch. Later as a chef, I hated it because it was a huge profit center that caused problems for me as an employer because all my cooks hated to do it. But it was such a moneymaker because people are so foolishly happy to pay $22 for the same 2 eggs and bacon, you know, that they have during the week for $7 or $3. You know, give them a free mimosa and a little strawberry fan, and suddenly they're happy to. I just had utter contempt for the entire enterprise. But now that I'm the father of a little girl.
You're happily throwing pancake parties for her and her friends.
Well, that makes me happy, seeing the look of delight in my daughter's eyes and her friends when her daddy offers an entire pancake bar with options for blueberry, chocolate chip, teddy bear, or regular pancakes. I'm feeling pretty good about myself with those customers.
All right, so back to the cookbook. You tell us about breakfast. One of the things I was shocked to read is you don't fry bacon. You cook it in the oven?
Yeah, I think it's first of all, it's nicer. I mean, you know, you stink up the whole. I live in an apartment in New York, so frying bacon, first of all, is going to stink up the whole apartment. Second of all, it's really, particularly if you're naked, never fry bacon while naked. It's a very dangerous business, and it's just not the best way to evenly cook bacon. Most of us like crispy bacon, or at least evenly cooked, and the best way to do it, in my experience, and the way we always did it in restaurants, was to lay it out on baking parchment and put in the oven and cook patiently but evenly, turning occasionally because there are hot spots in ovens. You might get a much better product.
Do you often cook naked?
Well, not now that I have a 9-year-old around, no. But prior to that experience, I did have some bacon-related, nudity-related injuries that were memorable, let's put it
comfort
that way.
Comfort is comfort, yeah. Anthony Bourdain hosts the CNN series Parts Unknown, now in its 8th season. His new cookbook is called Appetites. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Inada, Japanese maker of full-body massage chairs, including the Flex 3S with pre-programmed shiatsu massages and full-body stretch sessions at InadaUSA.com. That's InadaUSA.com. And from CFP, Certified Financial Planner Professionals, committed to providing financial planning in the client's best interest, from taxes and investments to saving for college and planning for retirement. More at letsmakeaplan.org.
This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with food writer and TV host Anthony Bourdain. He has a new cookbook called Appetites. His series, Anthony Bourdain Parts Unknown, explores cultures and cuisine around the world. It's in its eighth season on CNN. We are now in your third television show. You did a show called No Reservations for the Food Channel, right?
Yep.
And then The Layover, 48 hours.
And actually, before that, there was a cook's tour.
So okay, right.
Third network, fourth show.
Right. And now you're traveling around the world, visiting places in parts unknown. And I thought we'd begin with the clip. This is the beginning of your trip to Borneo on the series. Let's just listen how it starts.
When I first went up this river, I was sick with love. The bad kind. The fist around your heart kind. I ran far, but there was no escaping it. It followed me upriver all the way. That was 10 long years ago. A previous episode of a previous series in a previous life. Yet here I am again, heading up to that same longhouse in the jungle.
And that's from your series, Parts Unknown. You know, these are part travelogue, part personal essay, and a lot about food. This seemed really personal. What did you want to, why did you want to go back to this little village in Borneo for after 10 years?
I think I wanted to see how things had changed. I think someone said, some travel writer said that, you know, you what you're really looking at when you travel is inward all the time. I think in a lot of ways, the first time I went up that river, the Skrang River, from Kuching up to a Iban longhouse in the jungle, I was heartbroken. I was coming off of a love affair that did not pan out the way I had hoped. I think in a lot of ways, the motivation for the show, the second one, was to see if it still hurt, you know, to see how I felt. So it was very personal. I thought I'm going to go right back to the same longhouse. Yes, let's see how that community has changed. Let's do a better job with better cinematography, bringing to bear all of the things that I've learned and my crew has learned in the intervening years. But really, it was revisiting an old wound to see if it was okay now.
There's a moment in this, a powerful scene in there. I mean, in this episode where you're standing in a pouring rain with a spear in your hand. You've been granted an honor by the village.
Yeah.
Explain this.
Well, I think both times that I went to the village as the guest of honor, you know, they kill a pig for the feast. The whole village eats. There's an equitable division of pig parts. It's a big deal. But that first time, I don't think I'd ever killed an animal before. I mean, I'd been ordering them up as a chef over the phone, so I was culpable in the death of many animals. But here I was being asked to physically plunge a spear into the heart of a pig. I didn't want to let the team down. I didn't want to dishonor the village or embarrass anyone. The first time was very, 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 very difficult. My camera guys almost passed out. It was certainly very difficult for me. The second time, as much as I'd like to say that it was still really hard, and I think I said in the voiceover, I don't know what it says about me, probably something very bad, that I've become, you know, I have changed over time. I like to think in good ways for the most part, but I've also become more callous. I've become able to plunge a spear into the heart of a screaming pig and live with that much more comfortably than I did the first time. And I could lie and say it tormented me forever and since, but you know, I felt that ugly emotion or lack of it, and I thought I should mention it.
Yeah, you said I did it this time without hesitation or remorse.
Yeah.
But it was a relief when the screaming stopped.
Well, yes. No good person likes to hear or see an animal in pain. That is monstrous. I mean, I tried very hard to do a good job quickly. Yeah, exactly right.
You had a memorable episode recently where you went to Vietnam. And I can't remember whether you said this in an episode or whether I read it somewhere else. You said the world tilted for you in a Vietnamese rice farmer's home.
Yeah, I think the first time I went to Vietnam, I remember coming away from it thinking, I have to have more of this. This is what I want to do with the rest of my life.
Vietnam or more of that kind of
travel? I want to be able to come back to Vietnam again and again and again. And if this place is so wonderful, the world must be filled with many more wonderful and interesting and challenging and heartbreaking and inspiring and beautiful places, as it turned out to. But I really got that the first time I went there, I think I found myself sitting in it was a rice farmer's home in the Mekong Delta. At the time, they were a little more suspicious of Westerners with cameras. So the people who I was allowed to eat dinner with were all former Viet Cong with impeccable revolutionary credentials, the sort of people who you would think would be hostile to Americans, particularly in that area where they caught a lot of ugly action. I got just hammered drunk and had this sort of wonderful bonding experience. I remember this like 85-year-old former Viet Cong. I asked him, "Aren't you angry about anything?" And he looked and with amiable contempt said, "Look, buddy," basically in Vietnam, "don't take yourself so seriously. Before you, there were, you know, the French, the Japanese, you know, the Chinese, the Cambodians. Since you, there's been, you know, I've been fighting, this country's been fighting for 600 years. Don't take it personally. Now drink." And I just had this wonderful time. And Vietnam is a country that I go back to at every opportunity, meaning as soon as I can make another show, getting away with making another show there, I do.
I want to listen to another clip. You know, as we said, the show is part personal essay. It's part about travel and the countries and about food. And this is a moment in your trip to Borneo before you go up the river where you sit down in a noodle house.
Ah.
Let's listen to this.
If I look at my life as a continuum, a trail of noodles going round and round the world until it comes right back to the same spicy bowl. Oh, yeah. That is, can I say tumescent on CNN? Yeah, I'm pretty sure I can. Oh, yeah, baby. This is just a magical dish. I don't know, it's like two types of noodles, I think. Chicken, prawn, coconut, chili. And, you know, the main event of this is the broth. The wisdom of the ages is contained in there. It's like super complex. A truly happy moment.
Can you taste that stuff now?
It is in fact a constant. It is a reliable source of happiness for me. A bowl of spicy noodles, or a bowl of like decent pasta in Italy. Both. There's something there that I'm always able to respond to in an emotional way rather than a critical way, and that's important.
You're known for being willing to eat just about anything. What's some of the most intimidating or nasty stuff you've been offered?
I don't know. I mean, at this point, if freshness and hygiene is a question, I mean, generally it's tribal situations that are problematic where the whole tribe, the chief is offering you something that's what they have. And often they don't have refrigeration. It's often old. Their tolerance for meat that's even spoiled is higher than my relatively sensitive stomach. Often these dishes are eaten in one large bowl with the whole tribe jamming their fingers in. So, rotten food that's clearly not clean, water that's clearly not good. Those are a challenge. On the flavor spectrum, I'm pretty good with just about everything. There are a few dishes that are, you know, when you get to like rotten shark in Iceland, that's, I mean, I could do it, but I'd rather not. Won't be doing that again.
You did it?
Yeah. It's unpleasant, but I mean, it's not the end of the world. I don't know. For sheer soul-destroying misery, like if you're talking about a bite of food that just makes me question the future of the human race and just sends me into a spiral of depression, I think eating at an airport Johnny Rockets pretty much would be the nadir.
That's as bad as it gets. In a circumstance that you just described where there's food that's rotten or not clean, how do you handle it?
You take one for the team and you hope for the best and hope that you have a good supply of antibiotics. I've lost 3 days of work in 16 years. Only 3 days that I've been, you know, down for the count and confined to bed and desperately, horribly ill. Generally speaking, if it's like a street food stall that's busy, even if it looks dirty as hell, if there are a lot of locals there, they're eating and they're happy, my crew will always eat at that place. Eating a Caesar salad at the major chain hotel in, you know, Central Africa or the Middle East, that's where you run into trouble stomach-wise, generally.
You must have a heck of a microbiome.
I would think so. I think everyone on our show, all of our veteran crew, are pretty good about that. We have pretty good resistance. We don't get sick easily. And when somebody new joins the team, you know, we tell them the rules of the road. But if after we've told them general do's and don'ts, if we find ourselves sitting at as happened in, I think, Kurdistan in Iraq, and we're with some new member of the team says, oh, look, zuppa di vongole, like seafood, like a seafood stew. And we're awful far from the ocean right now. And we all looked at each other and we're like, should we tell them? Should we say something? And we all just said, no, let them learn.
Is it true in Namibia you were offered an unwashed warthog rectum?
Yeah. Well, they killed a pig, and apparently that was the chief yanks that part out and throws it on the grill and grills it medium rare and splits it with me. And I, look, the whole tribe is watching. He's offering me what he sees as the best part. That's a clear take one for the team situation. What am I going to do, refuse him, embarrass him in front of his people? Look ungrateful. That changes the whole tenor of the relationship. I mean, when somebody's offering you food, they're telling you a story. They're telling you what they like, who they are. Presumably, it's a proud reflection of their culture, their history, often a very tough history. You turn your nose up at that important moment, the whole relationship changes, and it will never be the same.
What did it taste like?
It tasted like exactly what you would expect, a sandy, gritty rectum.
Okay. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, we're speaking with Anthony Bourdain. His CNN series, Parts Unknown, is now in its 8th season. Some of the episodes, a lot of them are about food, some about travel, some about, you know, your personal feelings. And sometimes, I mean, like the episode on the Congo, a lot of that is about just the history of that nation and it being brutalized by Westerners and their...
There was no expectation that it would be obscene to go to the Congo looking to do a food show. We do many food-centric shows. We do comic shows. But some shows are agenda-driven. And I had an agenda here, and that was to, for an hour of television, talk about the history of this, the tragic, incredibly tragic, afflicted history that most people are unaware of. This wealthy in natural resources, this massive country. I was sort of obsessed with this, the tragically little known history of this very complicated country, and I wanted to talk about it. I also have a long, it's a repeating theme on the show, both Apocalypse Now and Conrad's Heart of Darkness. So that was an irresistible impulse to go up the Congo River.
As you've traveled around the world so much, and you love street food, but you've seen kind of cheap, authentically made food, and you've seen a lot of poverty and how people get by. Has that made you less interested in high end dining?
Yeah, I think because on one hand, I'm happiest in experiencing food in the most purely emotional way, and it's true of most of my chef friends as well. when it's like street food or a one chef, one dish operation, where there's just somebody who's really, really good at one or two or three things that they've been doing for a very long time that's maybe reflective of their ethnicity or their culture or their nationality. Those are the things that just make me happy. And I'm spoiled, like a lot of fellow chefs. We get a lot of fine wines and dinners thrown our way. And you do reach this enviable point where you just don't want to sit there for 4 hours with course after course after course. It's too much, first of all. It doesn't feel good at the end of all that time. And it's not interesting, and you don't want to, you know, if the waiter's taking 10 minutes to describe each dish, you know, it only took you three to eat it, something's really wrong. I mean, I think people lose sight of the fact that chefs should be ultimately in the pleasure business, not in the look-at-me business.
You sometimes visit places where there are really contentious political issues.
Yes.
You say you're not a journalist, mm-hmm. you're a storyteller, but you must think carefully about how you deal with that stuff.
Well, there's nothing actually more political than food. I mean, who's eating, who's not eating. Also, I found it just very, very useful to not be a journalist. I mean, journalists drop into a situation, ask a question, people sort of tighten up. Whereas if you sit down with people and just say, hey, what makes you happy? What's your life like? What do you like to eat? More often than not, they will tell you extraordinary things, many of which have nothing to do with food. So, yeah, we've shot in some pretty contentious places. We shot in Beirut during the war and since, Congo, Gaza, post-Benghazi Libya. I'm not a journalist, but I think it is useful as an addition to journalism to have seen what people are like in Libya, for instance. I mean, who are these people we are talking about when we talk about Benghazi or Libya? Is it not useful to see them with their kids, to see how their lives, their everyday lives, are doing seemingly ordinary things or trying to do ordinary things, to show what people actually live like in Iran, who may not support their government at all? What are ordinary people like in Iran? We seem all too eager and willing to ignore those things. And I think in southern or sub-Saharan Africa in particular, we seem to be so used to seeing people of color in these disastrous situations that we become inured and callous. So it's always useful to, especially in Africa, to say, look, you know, there are lives happening here. This is what's involved in getting water for the table. You know, this is how nice people can be, or how gentle or complicated, or it just seems to me the more you are able to show people's everyday lives, often as they revolve around food and daily tasks, when something happens in the news, you have a better idea who we're talking about here.
Anthony Bourdain, thanks so much. It's been fun.
Thank you.